at Irregular Hours, episode 166 for June 8th, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Summertime Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Fedora.
And we are here in the summertime. Happy summertime to everybody, especially Summertime Chip. Summertime. What? And the living is easy.
It is. It may not officially be summer, but, you know, school's out for some of the people around here. And that means that we all have a good time and we grab books and we start reading.
And destroy my kitchen. That's my summer project. That's great. It's a great idea. Let's tear up parts of the house. Yes, our summer reading. That's the fun part. We're reading How to Avoid a Climate Disaster by Bill Gates. This was published in February of 2021. It's a brand new book all about climate change, our third climate change book. And our first chapter this week is all about electricity.
So yeah, I thought the electricity chapter was really interesting. And I have to say, I really like how Gates organizes these five big elements that he's going to look at. So how we plug in, how we grow food, how we stay warm, or how we control our temperature. So yeah, what stood out for you guys in the electricity chapter? I thought there was a lot to dig into on this one.
The intro where he said that electricity is 27% of the power that we use on the planet was interesting for me, because we think of electricity as the problem in climate change. The production of electricity is the thing that we need to change. And he said, well, it is one of the problems that we need to change, but it's the one that we maybe have the most control over. That's the part that I got out of this chapter, was we humans can make changes to how we produce electricity.
And I think, Steve, even more than we humans, it's like we as individuals.
Right.
So I feel like so many of the other anthropogenic or human-caused carbon emitters are much more systemic, whereas like we individually have control over our own electricity use. I really liked how he went through the problem of intermittency, this notion that so often where we produce power is not very close to where we're using the power. And I have these very optimistic ideas about solar and wind, because I think they're very easy to understand. And you're like, yeah, we have all this sun, we have all this wind, we should be using it more effectively. But in fact, a lot of the places where we have the ability to generate power using solar and wind are not always very close to big cities, especially wind. And then how do you actually transport the energy is a huge question.
So as a futurist, this was certainly one that tickled my brain quite a bit. Because I think that the issue that he was talking about, where electricity can be produced and where it needs to actually be, is something that's been part of the challenge since the beginning of electricity. And if we think of what Edison was running into the problem with the repeaters, and then you think of what Tesla was introducing that required fewer repeaters, we're running into that same issue here. Mm-hmm. Places that we can produce the electricity, well, they could be a long way from where we need it. I also really enjoyed that this was an area that I think that, at least in the West, is much simpler to solve. I immediately was thinking of Europe and even some of the news that we were dealing with this week, that Germany produces so much power that it's creating a problem with some of the neighboring countries, because they're dumping some of the power at time onto their grids because it's so cheap. And what type of problems it could be, that could certainly be opportunity for those countries around them to adopt similar policies as Germany is, as far as producing electricity. And the United States certainly is in a place where solar and wind certainly can expand, but he talked a little bit about where, at least is hinting where this should ultimately go. And that's one of the real holdup of where electricity being produced has been challenged for many, many years, because there is a lot of fear in looking at nuclear power, and rightly so. But there's modern ways of trying to solve some of the engineering issues. If the West can solve this, that's not enough, because we have a whole world out there that doesn't have the resources, that will have access to cheap fossil fuels, and ultimately they're going to have needs, and we're going to have to figure out a way to get some of those areas up and running by, if 2050 is going to be the magic time that we need to have this all up and running with zero emissions, being a zero carbon neutral policy. I'm trying to think of the term.
The importance is like net neutral, right? Yeah.
If that was the goal, the challenge is not going to necessarily be the West. That'll be ambitious. It's going to be trying to get these other areas in that same boat.
And one thing that really stood out for me, well, there were so many, but was the idea that, in the US, we only spend 2% of GDP on electricity, right? And that's because it's a very efficient system. But in parts of the world where electricity is far less reliable, and as he mentioned in the first three chapters, something like a billion people don't have reliable access to electricity, people end up spending a large percentage of their disposable income on just charging their phone at some sort of public site, something that we just completely take for granted. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm really excited to be reading this book, because I think Gates has such a unique profile in that he's this real computer guy, deep, deep, deep computer guy and CEO, but he also is a philanthropist who's spent much of the last two decades thinking about underdeveloped parts of the world. And so he's got that really neat perspective. Now, I think, I thought that this notion, and he doesn't question it. He's like, look, we absolutely need to double, maybe even triple our electricity supply by 2050. That's just the equitable thing to do. We can't in the West be like, we control electricity, other people don't have access. No, we absolutely have to make reliable electricity available to every person on the planet. And that's just non-negotiable. We just need to know how to do it cleanly. One of his solutions, which I think is really interesting, but then there's also a counter argument that he didn't look at, is he has funded this big computer model project to figure out the best grid. And it sounded like that was specifically in the US, but I don't see why you wouldn't be able to actually scale that up to use it in other parts of the world as well. And so I think obviously that's super smart and a great idea that we should be figuring out, how do we move the electricity? What are the efficiencies that we can find? Now, I recently read another book about our grid that I thought was really interesting, about the fact that we in the US don't have very much security around our power grid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite vulnerable. Now, I think that, is it true that, am I remembering correctly, the three of us read that book, One Second After by William Florsheim?
Yes, Pam. This is,
yes, I thought so.
This is one of those books that has really stuck with me. You introduced it to us on the old show before we did the book club. And that's, yes.
Yeah,
that's to scare everybody.
That's a scary book.
I've brought this book to a few different groups because it's such an interesting take, right, on our completely unquestioning reliance. We just don't take a lot of time to think about, how did these lights just come on? What does that mean? And how are we having this call by Zoom this morning? And what would it be like if that was turned off? What do we individually know about turning the electricity back on? Pretty much nothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I did think that if you're going to do that computer model, thinking about the grid, you might also consider protecting the grid against both the elements and potentially against terrorism.
Mm-hmm. So this is where the futurist comes out in me. So this is exactly how this would be pushed through. How do you get something that is a political challenge there? And you're correct. When we talk about the security, we're talking about the ability to hack it, shut it down, things of that nature. We experienced something just a week or so ago, mm-hmm, in the Southeast, where we had the oil or gas pipeline that was shut down in the sort of the panic it caused. There wasn't havoc. It was panic in the sense that people were lining up to get fuel and people were taking way more than they would normally end up taking. My favorite story being Wilmington, North Carolina, which I found out gets their oil off of tankers sitting off of the side of the coast. But people in Wilmington were still lining up to fill up with fuel just in case that pipeline, which they don't rely on, you know, wasn't available. Mm-hmm. But the way you would end up pushing this through on a political landscape would be the same way we got the interstate system. The interstate system was initially set up as a Department of Defense initiative. And that was to move the military from one side of the country to the other side of the country and up and down the coast. So if we're going to push something like this, and this is a very ambitious big project, it would be pushed through as a Department of Defense type of initiative. It's important to have electricity. We need to have a secure system to be able to do this. Well, how are we going to do that? We're going to put it through as a defense initiative. And then later on, there'll be, you know, the parts where we get to deal with the engineering schools and all the other parts to set up how this would ultimately be. So I do think that that is how we get through the political hurdles, because there's always going to be every other challenge you deal with when you're dealing with an initiative of this size. There's going to be holdouts, people not willing to sell their land, rights of those lands and things like that. How do you get through defense? Defense is going to be how you're going to be able to push a lot of this through. And we don't talk policy in this book. We're talking big picture and what we need. But I was thinking politics initially on this and how to make this palatable.
Yeah, I'll be curious if, I wouldn't be surprised if like the final chapter addresses some of those policy questions a little bit more, or maybe it doesn't. I don't know where the book is going, but it feels like that's something that he's deliberately not raising and not even touching. But of course, as we're reading it, it's on our minds.
So let's go ahead and say it like George Bush would say it, nuclear, nuclear.
He certainly is proposing that nuclear power is the way to get this done, that the idea of putting up more power plants just about anywhere, you can put them wherever you need them to go in order to have the supply and the demand close to each other, certainly was the highlight of the next chapter, right?
I'm going to mention this part. Even though he doesn't talk about where they should be, you can imagine there are areas with very little population, desert areas, things of that nature. If you could move electricity from relatively uninhabited areas to areas that have a lot of habitation, big cities, things of that nature, wouldn't that be lovely? Having that infrastructure in place to move it seems to be a logical way of pushing that through also. So I think that even though this is not truly being addressed in this book, you can just imagine that a modern system, having the ability to move electricity up and down the coast, places like Nevada, places like Utah, where there's very little population, seem to be lovely places to put some of these grids on the West Coast, and then you could figure out where to put them in the Midwest and the East Coast.
So what is your feeling about nuclear power? I mean, this is obviously a really big portion of these three chapters. What kind of preconceptions did you come into this book with as you start reading about nuclear power? It seems so scary, but good.
Think of the scary part, Fukushima, you know, having some event happen just like that. And I think if I read correctly a couple of weeks ago, they released the water into
the ocean,
and Japan's release of that could impact the western mm-hmm. coast, Seattle, Washington area of thing, because your pollution that's in one place comes to another area. Who's responsible for it? That type of stuff. But if you also recognize that because of the scare factor, we really haven't been able to engineer, at least in the United States, the way they've done in France, where it was continuously worked upon And France gets, I can't remember, what was it, 70% of their electricity? Yes,
US gets 20% and France gets 70%.
And that a lot of that has to do with politics. I mean, a lot of that has to do with, you know, the Three Mile Island type stuff, even though Chernobyl's not in the United States. Those are all scary types of situations. Anytime you put together something that has to do with atomic power or nuclear power, as you're dealing with forces that could be very scary, but on the same note, it is clean. And then, you know, there's waste involved and like that, and that'll be the interesting part on how we eventually start getting rid of those wastes. But I mean, relatively speaking, compared to carbon, this is seems to be our answer.
And it's interesting because I live pretty close, about 15 minutes from a nuclear power plant. And so every year I get this little form from school that says, in the case of a nuclear power plant accident, do you or do you not consent that your children would get the following medical treatment, you know, at school in the event of a disaster? So, you know, it's just a reminder, because it's so funny, because I don't, like, if you said, where's the closest nuclear plant? Like, I don't really think of it. Oh, yeah, like, I drive by it all the time. Friends who work at Millstone, of course. But yeah, it is kind of just part of the grid here. But obviously, that's only 20% of the power of the U.S.
And while our listeners cannot see visuals, they're just listening to us, I just want to mention that, that Pam, you're glowing this morning. And you're...
Thanks. But here's the thing that I think Gates does a pretty good job of explaining, is that when you look at the stats, it's just like people are afraid to fly in airplanes, because when there's a single airplane crash, it's such a huge deal. But of course, statistically, it's so much more dangerous to drive in your car.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the average person, certainly me, doesn't have a full understanding of how nuclear power works. And because when there is a disaster, it is so devastating. Mm-hmm. I think that we forget, you know, how many people die slow deaths due to coal plants, which we rely on as the mainstay of our energy grid.
And think about 30 or 40 years ago, we had leaded fuel, you know, the gasoline that we used and the smog it caused. And then we had to switch to unleaded fuel. So, you know, if we look at it as a progression and evolution, you know, we're continuously refining, you know, we're having access. We feel like, you know, there's a bad element. How can we take that bad element? How can we improve? Just we continually try to improve those opportunities to give us what we need or what we're demanding, but also, you know, clean it up as it happens.
And the rarity of the accidents makes it so that it is something that we pay attention to. Just like with the auto versus airplane analogy, the idea that the rarity becomes the thing that you are afraid of, because yes, it's terrible when there's an accident, but because it's so rare, we can rely on most of the time nuclear power taking care of it.
And once again, of course, Gates is working on a computer model to actually build power plant with very specific specifications. And so this is one of the things I like about this book, is the idea of using computing power, including, he doesn't actually use the word artificial intelligence, but of course, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about using stochastic techniques with big data to make decisions that humans simply don't have the computing power in our tiny individual brains to come up with these kinds of solutions. And so he avoids the word artificial intelligence, but I think we can use it. And once again, he has a computer-based approach to thinking about the nuclear power problem.
And a company called TerraPower that he has been backing. And an announcement was made on Wednesday, June 2nd, that the first power plant will be built in Wyoming. So once again, this book club is right on the news, because June 2nd, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett came together and announced that they are going to build a power plant in Wyoming.
Now that's so cool. Now, At the end of this chapter, Gates happily announces that his nuclear power plant will be fully automated, and so it removes the danger of any human error. And he says this in like this super positive way, and I'm listening to the audiobook. I love Will Wheaton. He's an excellent narrator for this book, and it's just like, great news, everybody. We won't have to worry about human error.
Oh my God.
For those of us who are science fiction readers, what does that make us think? Are we like, yay, no human error equals...
Isn't that the fatal conceit?
Right.
Hayek talked about the fatal conceit, and that is thinking that computers are going to be able to answer. Computers are stupid. Computers mm-hmm. do what humans help them. Human decisions have to be made on top of those. Mm-hmm. And humans are fallible. Get that. But yeah. Computers can help organize, but they can't ask the right questions. And that is a conceit. That is certainly something that, at least in logic, you have to be aware of. But the idea, I think the solution is the correct solution. And I think that going forward, it is the correct solution. But you cannot say that there is no danger. There is always danger. It is part of the existence.
Are you saying that the Earth doesn't care
if we're here or not? But you know what? Humans probably care.
I'm sure that there's a schlock movie somewhere where a nuclear power plant was run totally by robots and it's all gone terribly wrong.
The AI, was it on Twitter? And all of a sudden, you know, it comes back. What was the program that they ran? It came back super racist.
The bot that was running on Twitter. Yeah,
yes.
The Twitter bot that came, that was learning how to use language from all the people, and it came back totally racist after like a week. Yeah.
Oh boy.
Computers may not always be the answer.
Well, there's a social science experiment that's probably more about people than about computers. But anyway.
You got that right.
But it was funny because as I was reading this very optimistic view, I was reminded of that famous Warren G. Bennis quote, "The factory of the future will have only two employees, a man and a dog. The man will be there to feed the dog. The dog will be there to keep the man from touching the equipment." I love that.
Oh, that is awesome. That's a great quote.
Right. And I think like that's the future that Gates is picturing. And I feel like I am very much of two minds because I really, at the same time, I'm like, you know what? That's probably a good idea. And then I'm like, unless it's the worst idea ever. So yeah, that's, you know, welcome to the world of futurism. It's very fun to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The futurism of AI and machine learning is compelling in both the positive and the negative. My goodness, what we're doing with machine learning today and the ability for Google, for instance, to understand how things work is both frightening and intriguing because we could get to some great solutions to some problems using this technology.
Well, I just sat through an MBA speech at the university or a presentation at the University of Chicago for their students. And that was one of the issues that was brought out, AI or big data, or whatever the latest term is for this. We have to truly remember that AI, big data, whatever it is not asking the questions. Humans are asking those questions. Humans are driving this information. That only helps to put things together. Maybe it tightens it up some. Maybe it helps organize our way of thinking it so we can grasp it. But ultimately, it's as stupid as anything you could do without the right questions being asked. And those are going to come from leadership. They're going to come from individuals.
So you're saying deep thought came up with the answer to life, the universe, and everything, which is 42, but the people didn't know what the question was, and that's why the Earth was created? Is that what you're saying, Chip?
Well, I guess you could say it that way, Steve.
Sure, that's exactly what you're saying.
Bring Douglas Adams into anything, Steve.
Now, so I think that Gates had some very interesting AI solutions to both, or not solutions, approaches to solving the problems of electricity and nuclear power. Now, when we got to the agriculture chapter, I think it was, we went in a bit of a different direction. So I was super curious as I was reading this. This was the one I couldn't wait to hear what you guys thought about. What did you think about Gates's ideas about meat? And I love how he sets it up like, I grew up in a burger joint. My dad loves burgers more than...
That was a great analogy, wasn't it? That was a great story.
He practically had his office in a burger joint.
He was getting mail at the burger joint.
That's
right.
That's so how they were running the Gates Foundation. That was the interesting part.
Yeah, this is the early days. That's right.
Dad was answering questions at the burger joint.
So, what did you think about Gates's idea? This is hardly his idea, but as he lays it out in this chapter, that you guys, we need to eat less meat.
All I could think of was your schedule of your consumption of meat, Pam, because we've talked about this several times over the last few years. You have a very thought-filled relationship with meat.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I grew up on a subsistence farm and I ate beef every day of my life from age 0 to 18. We had all of our own meat. And so that was very much how I grew up. And we had our chickens, our cows. We traded a quarter of a cow for half a pig from one of our neighbors because we didn't grow our own pigs. But I grew up with an absolutely meat-based diet. And I have, over the past 10 years, gone to a half or two-thirds, you know, vegetarian diet. And it's very much because of environmental concerns. I do enjoy meat very much. But I do think this is something that I've personally been doing. So I, of course, was like, go Gates, this is exactly what we all need to be doing. In terms of just the amount of land and resources required to grow, especially to grow beef. But I mean, the only way you get chicken in the quantities we get it isn't very ethically comfortable for me either. So between ethics, environment, and health, I do think we need to rethink our relationship with meat.
The real challenge we're dealing with right now is not being brought up in this chapter. For at least in the last history of humans, we've been on the verge of starvation for so, so long. And this idea of cheap calories as we have them right now is running havoc on the bodies. All you have to do is go across the United States, go any place and see what, when I say average, the typical family is dealing with and the health issues that we're dealing with. So now we're getting cheap calories, but they may not be the right type of calories. So I don't know how we're going to be able to reintroduce how to eat back into it. But what we've determined is that eating meat could be the issue, but that's maybe only for the real, real wealthy people, because the average family, I shouldn't say the average family, many families are living on pastas and processed foods and things that are relatively inexpensive, but they're just... The human body is rejecting them. They're becoming bloated and fat, and certainly we've got to find a different way of working with our calories. His idea of using Beyond Meat and what was the other?
Impossible Burgers.
Impossible Burgers. I'm not convinced that that's healthier than eating meat. That may be...
Oh, really?
Well, they're processed foods. And so that may not be the answer. I mean, the answer may be to eat more true vegetables as opposed to meats. I still don't understand if a person is going vegetarian or vegan, why they would demand something that is at least has the feel of meat. I mean, it just seems counterintuitive. But anyway, I spent a week with my cousins who are vegetarians or pescatarians, which is basically means they eat
fish.
And I saw how they were eating, and I could eat that way. It's not all pasta, but there are lots of vegetables, and these are good for us. They take away inflammation into the body. They heal the body. There's a lot of other good things to do it. I think we're going to have to find a way to reintroduce how we eat in a different way. I don't necessarily think that the plant-based meat is going to be what the solution is going to be.
And it's funny because I think in a way, Beyond Meat, which by the way, I'm a huge fan of Beyond Burgers. I thought that was so funny. I think they taste way better than meat-based burgers. So that was so funny when Gates is like a huge investor in this, which I had no idea about, because that is something that I actually am a big fan of. But this chapter encapsulates the whole approach he's taking to the climate crisis, which is like, don't worry, we don't need to change too many things about our lifestyles. We just need to change our technology. So what you're saying right there, Chip, is like, no, maybe we need to really like rethink our relationship with processed foods and really go with whole foods, which of course I completely agree with that. But on the other hand, I think that's not the argument Gates is making at all. I agree with this one. But the argument Gates is making is like, we can invent our way out of all of our problems.
I think for at least the United States, and I'm going to compare it to Europe for an example, how we've designed our cities is one of the real challenges we have on how our relationship to food is. It has to deal with, if you have to go out to the Walmart or out to the grocery store, you're driving somewhere. So you're going to pick up all this food. And let's just say you cook half of it or you use half of it and you're throwing away part of it. Well, that's very different than being in a European city where you're walking and when you're walking home or biking home, you pop into the grocery store, you get the food for the day. And you take that home and you're using it for the day because, they're going to be there tomorrow. You're going by it tomorrow. So I think there's a design issue that could be part of this on how our communities are at least established in the United States or in North America.
I love that you bring that up, Chip, because I moved just a few months ago and I moved to a place where I'm like a half mile from a really nice grocery store. And I walk over there practically every day and it does really change. It's funny because now I do like a big shop maybe once a month to get all kinds of, big heavy things that I need my car to move home. Mm-hmm. But really, I just go to the grocery store every day. And I completely agree with Gates that one of the biggest things we have to do, environmentally, but also just like for ourselves is not throw food away. Something so sad when you look into your fridge and you're like, oh, I forgot about that item. I'm going to have to throw it away. It's just like, it's just waste writ large. And you're like, what am I doing? And so I do agree that, so like when he said that 20% of food gets thrown away in most places and 40% of food is thrown away in the US, 40%, that's insane. But it's not like I don't believe him. It's just a really horrible number. And certainly that's just, think about all of the emissions that went into creating that food that we're not even consuming.
Well, when you go to the grocery store and you buy the big bag of potatoes, or you buy the bag of salad, or whatever you're buying, maybe on a bulk that's a lot larger. And maybe the answer is, we're already starting to see a lot of the grocery stores having large amounts of prepared foods. And I'm not talking about prepared foods that are hamburgers, hot dogs.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you can buy this and it's already prepared, and all you have to do is go home and heat it up for your family. Maybe we need to rethink on how we're buying foods so that while it may be a little more expensive, it's more, you're not wasting it because it's already prepared for you. And it's real food as opposed to bags of chips and things like that are incredibly processed that may not be good for us.
And incredibly delicious. Let's not forget that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's the problem, right? The things that taste so good. But anyway, it was funny because I just thought this chapter was really interesting. And it was really, like, it's so different than the other chapters. And yet there's this little strain of we can still invent our way out of it. So I don't know. I thought this was a very good chapter.
We've gotten rid of a lot of the home economics courses in school and a lot of shop classes in schools. That may be too bad because what it did for a whole generation of people, and while it certainly could be sex-based and we could critique it on that level, we had a whole group of people who didn't have skills on cooking and building things and stuff like that, that seems to have been lost. Even the Home Depot CEO a year ago said, before COVID, that they had to start teaching classes on how to use tools because no one knows how to use tools today. And it could be that we just have lost, because of processed foods and creating cheap processed foods, we've lost the ability to use, well, at one time we just needed calories. Now we don't need calories. We need better calories. But we've lost our ability to use the foods that are available. I still think there's a design issue on our cities on this. I think there's just lost skills and just not being aware of our virtue. By virtue of us reading more than I think the average person, we may be a little more enlightened, or maybe we're just a little more confused. But I think there's just a whole generation that just their skill set has just not been improved on this area.
Is this the right time for me to share with you, like, my glory days when I actually won my eighth grade shop award?
Dun, dun, dun.
I'm just saying. I built this beautiful set of shelves using black cherry wood. I remember it so fondly, and I think that's the last thing I ever built when I was 13 years old. But I loved shop class.
Sure, but that ability to use your home.
No, I think we haven't. Yeah, we have lost that. I agree with you.
Not everybody gets to destroy their bathrooms and kitchens, you know, for the summer, Steve.
I don't think you should say destroy the bathroom. I think that sounds really terrible.
I'm sorry. Redesign and rebuild. I don't know.
Yes. Yes, we are remodeling the bathroom and the kitchen this summer, so that's what I'm doing. And speaking as the only person in the Midwest in this conversation right now, I have to tell you, this conversation's making me hungry because we're all about food in the Midwest.
There you go. Lots of corn,
you,
Steve.
You people,
lots of
you
grain.
You people on the East Coast and your lifestyle where you walk to places and go to the beach. Okay, fine. I'm going to go have a pizza.
Well, listen, I have a Southern American diet down here. Don't worry. I mean, you may think the world is collard greens and turnip greens, but, you know, on the grand scheme of things, it's still meat and potatoes, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about bacon.
It doesn't make everything better.
All right, so guys, what were the main takeaways for you guys? So for each of us, let's go through. What are the main takeaways from these three chapters of Gates's book?
I said I found it very empowering. I think that the United States can solve this. I think Europe can solve this. I think that we've outlined where some of the developing areas, they're going to need help from the West to be able to go through this transition. I'm reading more into it. I do think that there could be some real challenges on the world on this, because if you're an area that is a producer of oil and your economy is going to change dramatically, well, you can either start dumping oil on the market, which could create some real havoc. And if you're an area that needs electricity, it's going to become very, very cheap for them to be able to put together old technology. We got to figure out a way to get the new technology to those areas.
For me, the idea of doing all of the things all at the same time is the best option. He talks about pulling carbon out of the air is possible, but it's not very efficient. But it is one of the pieces of the puzzle of getting this solved. So finding all of those solutions.
Yeah, and I really like just this one. I didn't take a lot of quotations out of this book the way that I often do, but one little tiny quote was, "We can't be afraid to bet on some crazy ideas." Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right, that we do have to, there are a number of things we know are going to make sense and that we need to pursue. But then, yeah, we have to like think outside the box as well. One of the things that I sort of found a little sad, I think that in my mind, I really have a lot of excitement about geothermal. And when he laid out the math in terms of green premiums, like how close are we on that? We're not very close, but I do agree with him that it's still worth trying because that does seem like a really great relatively untapped source of energy that we need to be thinking about.
I also left having a better appreciation for plastics because of they trap carbon. I'm not saying that there could be other challenges that we don't want to deal with, what it's doing to the human body. But the idea, I was really down on plastics before this chapter, and he says, oh, no, it traps some of that, where some of the other things that we're working on release it in the air and becomes more of a challenge. So anyway, listen, we live and learn, and we learn things all the time. So how lovely is that?
And more farts per page than any book that we've read in the book club thus far.
Well, what is the world going to be when Melinda's not there to hold him back from using the word fart?
Isn't that totally what you read in this sentence here? He says, by the way, when you get into this subject, you can end up having some weird conversations. Each year, Melinda and I published an open letter about our work, and in our 2019 letter, I decided to write about this problem of enteric fermentation in cattle. One day, as we were going over a draft, Melinda and I had a healthy debate about how many times I could use the word fart in a letter. She got me down to one. As the sole author of this book, I have more leeway, and I intend to use it. Isn't that all you thought about when you read that was, oh boy, Bill Gates is off the leash?
And all the little children snickered.
Exactly. Including
us. Even the big children.
That's right. Pull my finger.
All right. So these are interesting ideas that Bill Gates is bringing to us. Chip, what is our assignment for next week?
7 through 9. Those are the chapters we'll be reading. Hopefully they'll be equally as entertaining. And I look forward to our continued conversation on this.
Very good.
Yeah, I'm really going to be watching, as we've started to talk about today, to what degree does Gates take account of all the elements of a society, like politics, economics, culture, sociology. I think he's really trying to touch on these things, but I'll be curious to see how much he thinks about the sort of human element as we move forward.
Sure.
Interesting. Excellent. I'm intrigued by all of this conversation. I'm intrigued by this book. I'm glad that we are reading this and getting a little more knowledge about all the things that are going on. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think, Chip?
Only if we can come back next week.
How about you, Pam?
Absolutely.
All right. How about you out there? What are you thinking? What are you destroying in your house this summer? How is your summer going? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our email is sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. Our website is sandwiches@irregularhours.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasselblad.
And I'm Dan Bedore.
We'll see you in the future. What I want to talk about, what I want to think of, what I want to